Welcome, everyone. Thank you so much for joining. It feels like it's been a while since we connected, so excited to be back with you all. Just to start, is the sound okay? You can hear me all right? Everything all right with the sound? Perfect. Great. Well, let's do our usual drill. I always love to hear where everybody is. If you want to say hi in the chat and mention where you are joining from. As I mentioned a moment ago, I am in Minneapolis at the moment, and I'll be heading off to New York in a couple hours. And excited to be here and connecting with you all. Okay, here we come. Washington, Arizona, South Carolina, Canada, Mexico, Buenos Aires. Great, wonderful. I love this. I every time I see this, I never get bored of just seeing people all over the world practicing together. So I think most of you have probably been to these sessions in the past, but as you know, we've been going through some of the nuances, really, of the transmissions we've been getting from Mingyi Rinpoche and that we've been studying in the Theragar community. So I like to think that this is very much rooted in experience and very much not kind of overly intellectual or scholarly, but hopefully, you know, something that gets a little bit more in the fine points of meditation practice. So we've just switched gears from this amazing transmission we had on Mahamudra practice, this beautiful song of Mahamudra, the Ganges Mahamudra, as it's known. And now we are beginning to explore these teachings from Mingyi Rinpoche on Abhidharma practice. And it's perfect timing for me because this actually has been my practice the past year. I've been alternating Mingyi Rinpoche's, working with Mingyi Rinpoche's book. And since I can read Tibetan, I got a little bit of a sneak peek before the translation was done. So I've been working with that and alternating that with Nature of Mind practice. So actually, this has been my own practice, over the past year. And I've found it to be one of the richest periods of practice in a long time. And I think it has to do with this potent alchemy of Nature of Mind practice paired with some of the Abhidharma teachings, which sometimes can be a little dry, to be honest. You know, a lot of times it's lists and all these frameworks and lists, and it can feel a little dry and analytical. But if you apply it to experience, it is incredibly rich. So as reading material, it can be very boring. It's not meant, you know, it's the furthest thing from a page-turner novel than you could probably imagine. But if you take it less as reading material and more as a window into the mind, a window into exploring the mind and mental processes, then it really opens things up in a profound way. So today I wanted to talk a little bit about one very specific aspect of these teachings that comes from the Abhidharma teachings, and that is implicit. It's kind of the undergirding of some of the early part of Rinpoche's book that we're going to get into quite soon on shamatha practice and the mechanics of shamatha practice and how it's laid out in the tradition, and hopefully some of the experiential side that can help us really in many ways ground and energize our Nature of Mind practice through just simply the shamatha practices that have come down to us in the tradition. And specifically, I wanted to talk about what are known as the five jhana factors. These are five qualities of mind that we attune to and nurture and cultivate in practice, which again, I think can be incredibly helpful for us as Nature of Mind practitioners. So that's what I thought we could talk about today. And we can have a little bit of a discussion at the end. And just so you know, we're going to end, this session will be an hour. I have to hop on a plane, unfortunately, so I'm going to have to end a little bit earlier than usual. And that'll probably be a first because, as you all know, I am prone to running a little bit over. So you'll get to enjoy a rare moment of me being a little on the short side, which does not happen very often. So why don't we begin with a little practice? And I'm going to mix in a little bit of shamatha and nature of mind here, as will be the discussion, as I've mentioned, and then I will dive into the topic and we can explore that together. So go ahead and find a comfortable position. Bring some awareness into your body. We have this phrase that Tulku Urgyen Rinpoche used to say to Mingyur Rinpoche. You allow your body to rest on the cushion and bring your awareness to rest in your body. It's a really beautiful image. Allow your awareness to flow into your body, just to settle in your body. Take a few moments now to connect with the spirit of refuge and bodhicitta in whatever way works for you. This could be just reminding yourself of a motivation that we find in these two principles. But just create that inner space that helps us guide our practice. Once you've connected with refuge and bodhicitta, take a few moments to drop any shred of mental effort and just sit. Don't even meditate. You don't need to do anything with your mind. You can leave your senses wide open. And simply be here as you are in this moment. As you rest, bring a light awareness to your breath. Here you don't need to focus on any particular sensation, but rather just notice that breathing is happening. See if you can feel it throughout your whole body. So your whole body is being filled with the nourishing, healing energy of your breath. Time to time, you can take a few deep breaths. Again, just feel that healing, nourishing energy moving through your entire body. A very light, almost effortless awareness. might feel some vibration or tingling or a feeling of movement. And without focusing or applying too much mental energy, mental effort, just relax into those feelings. Nurture those healing feelings in your own body, that nourishing energy of your own breath. And again, zoom out a little bit and feel your entire body. So every cell of your body is being healed, nourished, rejuvenated. So every cell is breathing. And again, you don't need to think about this or analyze anything, just very gentle awareness and feeling the breath, feeling it move throughout your entire body. Now, let go of the orientation to your breath and just rest. You can still feel your breath open to what you see and hear and feel. Not holding on to anything, not blocking anything. No special state of mind you need to have. Very gently observe your mind. Who is meditating? Who is it that is aware of the breath? What is it that is aware of the breath? What is it that is aware of this meditation? Just look at your mind. In that moment of looking, you may have the experience of not seeing anything, like you're looking into open space. You don't see anything. Let go and relax. Rest. Okay. So one of the topics that is covered in the Abhidharma teachings, and the Abhidharma teachings are not unique to Tibetan Buddhism, although there's kind of different versions, different strands, but this is sometimes referred to as Buddhist psychology, which I guess is as good a term as any to describe what Abhidharma is all about. But one way to think about Abhidharma is that it's essentially a roadmap to understanding, experiencing, and transforming the mind. It helps us to tease apart all the subtle details of our inner experience, the workings of the mind, the workings of human experience, and then also what happens when we begin to practice, what happens through the process of transformation when we begin to meditate and explore our inner experience. So shamatha, of course, has always been part of the Buddhist tradition. It's not unique to Buddhism, but it's a hugely important part of the practice. And there's a whole progression, a whole roadmap specific to shamatha practice that lays out how that proceeds when you practice this, when you do these practices that are about connecting with and stabilizing awareness. How does that go? What actually happens and unfolds in experience? And there's all sorts of debates about shamatha practice, not only in Tibetan Buddhism, but in lots of other Buddhist traditions as well. In the Theravada lineages, there's all sorts of debates about, what are the states of the so-called jhana levels, which are these states of absorption. What do those actually look like? How are they experienced? How do you know when you're progressing through these levels? What is the role of them? Do you even have to do it? There's all sorts of debates and hair-splitting details about this, but I don't think any Buddhist teachers of any lineage disagree with the central role that simply stabilizing the mind plays in the overall process. So again, the details may vary, but whether you're a nature of mind practitioner or a Vipassana practitioner, we need to ground ourselves and stabilize the insight that we have. So insight is what ultimately undoes the causes of suffering. But without shamatha, insights are fleeting and unstable. So the metaphor that's often used is that shamatha is like this glass enclosure around the candle flame of insight. So the glass enclosure on its own, of course, isn't so helpful. But when you pair that with the flame of insight, it allows the flame to continue to grow and to emerge. So it plays this important role. Now, in nature of mind practice, it gets even more interesting because there's a really interesting question about how much concentration you need versus stability. Because as I'm sure you all know, the point of shamatha practice from a more nature of mind perspective is not really about the object. It's more about awareness itself. So we don't necessarily need to learn to concentrate perfectly on an object like the breath or anything else. But what we do need to do is increasingly ground ourselves in awareness. And eventually we gain insight into the very nature of awareness and we learn to stabilize that. Are you hearing me okay? It looks like my connection may not be great. Is the connection coming through all right? It is? Okay, good. So anyways, we could get into that, and we probably will get into that in future sessions, but there's a lot to be said about just how much shamatha you need for nature of mind practice, and what is the utility and role of it from the point of view of nature of mind. For me, at a very practical level, and here this is more my personal experience than necessarily the classical way of talking about this, I think there's really two very, very helpful roles that shamatha practice can play. And here I mean more kind of basic shamatha, like just working with the breath, practices like that. One obvious one is that it basically creates the inner workspace within which meditation can happen. Shamatha has a way of just clearing away the cobwebs of the mind so that we have a almost an inner space that provides the basis upon which we can start to explore what's happening. And I remember, you know, when I first started meditating, my mind was simply so filled with thoughts and so restless, so impulsive, jumping here and there, the proverbial monkey mind, that even if I had received nature of mind teachings, it honestly, I don't think would have been very fruitful, because my mind, there just wasn't enough space to do the inner exploration. So part of it is just simply creating that inner space. The inner space in and of itself is pleasant, but on its own, just creating that inner space, even if you perfectly stabilize it, it's not going to uproot the causes of suffering necessarily. Although it's certainly a better version of samsara than not having it. You know, it's basically the experience of a calm mind versus the experience of a busy, scattered mind. Of course, that's a more pleasant experience. But it's really the inner exploration that starts to shift things at a deeper, more fundamental level. But we just simply cannot do that. It's very difficult to do that if you don't have that inner space. So a lot of the debates that you find both in the Tibetan tradition and also in other traditions are around the point of how much stability do you need before you can start the process of inner exploration, the kind of insight practices that begin to get at the root of the problem of samsara. Nobody disagrees that you need some. Nobody disagrees that ultimately needs to be stable. But in some cases, you might go straight to insight and you kind of build the stability as you go. In other situations and other lineages and approaches, you do a lot of shamatha. You really spend a lot of time creating that inner space, stabilizing that, deepening that. And only then do you add in the exploration and the insight practices. And then some are more in the middle. So there's a lot of positions in terms of kind of how you do that in practice. My personal opinion on it is just people are different. What works for some people is probably not going to be as effective for others. And we all just need different things at different times. So it's probably good that we just have these different approaches and we can benefit from, even if we have one that works best for us, it's good to understand that wider space and the other options that are out there. So when it comes to the actual practice, what you find is that there's a whole progression that leads up to the point at which the mind really settles and begins to stabilize. And then there's a progression beyond that where you work with the factors, factors is as good a word as any, the factors that emerge in experience through that state of inner stability. And then you proceed even further beyond that. And at the beginning, there's an orientation usually to an object like the breath, but there's many other things you could take. You could even, in some classical traditions, even things like loving kindness and compassion actually could be the object of shamatha. So you have a state of deep stability and absorption that is focused on loving kindness, for example. And you're just kind of soaking in those feelings and stabilizing those feelings. But again, it could be the breath, it could be a mantra, it could be a sound. In Vajrayana practice, you might have a whole visualized experience and that becomes the basis for that stability. So there's many, many ways to do it, but they all are about the stability. They're all about the mind coming to a state of rest and equilibrium. But eventually, the mind moves beyond the object to what are called the formless realms in Tibetan Buddhism, and formless absorptions that are tied to those formless realms. So you actually let go of the object, and then you have states of boundless consciousness, for example, or feelings of kind of nothingness. And this is not the emptiness nothingness. This is just purely an expression of the shamatha experience. But what I wanted to mention specifically today is to go to the beginning of this progression and talk about the qualities that begin to emerge at the beginning of this whole progression through the various shamatha states. Because even if we don't go deeply into them, and again, there's debates about whether you even need to do this in nature of mind practice. The general view is that you don't and shouldn't. Nevertheless, I think the qualities themselves are helpful as a way to ground the practice, and they bring with some very important benefits. So before I jump into them, I just want to mention the second benefit. The first is this creating of the inner space that I've been talking about here. The second piece that I think is hugely important on an experiential level for us as meditators is that shamatha practice and the stability of mind brings with it what in Tibetan we call shinjang, which is what Mingyur Rinpoche usually refers to as pliability and workability. Simply put, the mind and the movements and energy of the mind, rather than working against us in meditation, rather than feeling like it's thwarting our practice, like we're trying to meditate and it's the restless energy is pulling us off track, we're getting distracted, we can't, or our mind just simply isn't doing what we want it to do, like we want to visualize something and we can't quite do it, or we want to focus on something and we can't stay with it. It's the opposite of that. It's almost as though your mind becomes a tool that you can apply in your practice. That's shinjang. It's working for you rather than against you. And the phrase that Rinpoche often says, Mingyur Rinpoche often says, that I think captures it perfectly. He often says this in Tibetan, dang dro shak de. And what that means, translated literally, is dang dro means if you send it, it goes. Dang dro, if you send it, it goes. Shak de means if you place it, it stays. Basically, your mind just does what you tell it to. And as we've all experienced many, many times over in meditation, that is rarely the case with the mind, right? I mean, a lot of what's going on in practice is the mind is doing exactly what we tell it not to do, right? The proverbial, like, you know, the Rinpoche says, the gives this example of like going to a picnic and the guards are like watching you, like you can't leave the park, you have to stay here. And suddenly you wanted to spend a nice day in the park, but because you feel like you're being watched, you just want to get out. And that's like what the mind is often feels like it's trying to do. It's like, oh, we're just going to sit here and watch the breath. And it's like the mind is basically just trying to escape that experience for half an hour when we meditate. Well, shinjang, this quality of pliability and workability, is when that energy really shifts. And that comes really through any kind of meditation. But in particular, it comes from shamatha practice. It comes through this groundedness of this of the mind and the stability of the mind. And in particular, it comes about when we bring a set of these inner factors called the jhana factors at times, or the qualities of absorption in other times, when we kind of bring these into balance and equilibrium. So specifically, in the first state of absorption, and this I mentioned there's a number of stages. Technically, there's four stages of absorption, and then there's these four that are the formless absorptions that I mentioned earlier. In the first of these, basically the first point at which the mind is truly stabilized, there's five factors. There's five things that start to emerge in experience. And again, they're really helpful just to understand these, because this is basically what you're doing in the practice. A couple of these are very obvious. The first one is just directing the mind towards the object. So the mind has this directedness to it. And this is a big, maybe one of the main skills that we're working with in meditation, certainly in shamatha practice, where you're just directing the mind to your breath. You're directing the mind to sound. You're directing the mind to your body or whatever it is you're paying attention to. It can even be to awareness itself, right? You know what you're orienting to, which might be awareness if it's open awareness practice. And that orienting of the mind is one of the critical ingredients of this whole process of shamatha. So the whole unfolding of shamatha, you could say, starts with that orienting of the mind. Normally what's happening is the mind is always orienting to something, but it's not intentional. The mind is always pointing somewhere. So what is it that's causing it to point wherever it happens to be pointed? Well, that's usually habit, right? we just go through our day and our mind sometimes gets pulled into what we're seeing and hearing. I'm in downtown Minneapolis right now in a big city. So, you know, I walk out the door, I hear a car honk, I hear somebody talking, and my mind is just pulled over there. It's pulled over there. It's habit and it's impulse. I'm not saying, oh, I heard a car honk and I'm now going to direct my mind there. It's not. It's just pure habit energy. And that's usually what's going on. So here, we are simply choosing intentionally where to direct our mind. And that intentionality is a critical piece of this whole process, in a way, the one that really starts it in the first place. And you can imagine that that's like a muscle. At the beginning, it's oftentimes a weak muscle. When I started to meditate, as I mentioned earlier, I was a college student, and I loved to think. I was kind of in this reflective part of my life, but my thoughts were very undirected. I would just kind of let my mind go, and it was nice in some ways. Sometimes it was kind of a toxic mess, but sometimes it was, you know, something I wanted to reflect on and think about. But in either cases, it was not really intentional. It was just my thinking mind just kind of going all over the place. I remember distinctly when I sat down to meditate, and really for a long time in those early months and years when I was learning to meditate, it was so hard to not get pulled into the current of thought. It was endlessly pulling me back. It was just like all the momentum was towards thought. And this muscle of being able to stay aware of what's going on, or direct my attention to my breath or whatever I was doing, it was almost like I didn't yet have that ability. I could do it a little bit. It would just be a minute or two, and then again, I'd be distracted. And it's just like anything. It's a skill. You need to build it up over time. So that's the first part. It's the orienting of the mind towards the thought, or towards the object. In Tibetan, the term for this is actually dokpa, strangely. It seems that, which means, literally it means thought, actually. It's similar to the word when we say, like, free from concepts, we say nam tok mepa or tokpa mepa. It's actually the same word. So there's always debates about what these things actually mean. But in this context, it's not like thinking thought. It's more the directedness of the mind that we're talking about. So that's the first one. The second of these qualities is sustaining the presence of your awareness and attention on whatever that object is. So there's the orienting, and then there's the staying with it quality. And of course, this is exactly what we do when we meditate. It's not enough just to orient the mind to the breath and let it go. You orient your mind, and then you stay with it. And the amount of effort you apply varies a lot depending on the instructions. In Mahamudra and Dzogchen, it's like you're dialing that effort down to the bare minimum, and eventually you're turning the effort all the way off, and you're letting it be almost feeling like a spontaneous flow. In other traditions, I don't think anybody would say you want to be super intense about it, but in other traditions, there might be a little more focus on that, the mental energy and the effort. But even in Mahamudra, you play with that. You kind of play with the dial. You kind of turn the dial up and down depending on the kind of practice. So there's actually a whole practice in Mahamudra. One of the kind of the key instructions of the Mahamudra tradition, where you're playing with the tightness and looseness of the mind. And this is really with these two factors of orienting and staying with or sustaining attention on the object. You're kind of dialing up and dialing down that effort is within the space of these two factors. These two, more than anything else, are kind of the key skills of shaman to practice. They're essentially the muscle memory that we're building through doing these practices. As you do them, a whole range of other things start to happen. Of course, we know the challenging side of it. We know we get distracted, we have reactions, sometimes all sorts of unexpected things happen in the body and mind. Old memories that we didn't even know we had, might emerge. Emotional experiences that, you know, sometimes things we're very familiar with might happen. Sometimes emotions might come up that we didn't even know we had. It can be very unexpected. On the other end of the spectrum, there can be experiences of everything from physical bliss, almost kind of an ecstatic feeling on one end of the spectrum, to very subtle feelings of ease and contentment. So that the third and fourth qualities, after the orienting of the mind and the sustaining of attention, are what you might call joy or bliss and contentment. And there's all these are kind of large categories, large areas of mental, emotional, even physical experience. They're kind of there's sort of a large, wide terrain of inner experience. But this, I would say, I want to rest or kind of focus on this one a little bit, because actually these two points have been really, really helpful for me, especially in recent years. And it goes back to what we practiced a few minutes ago, which is that nourishing, healing energy that I mentioned when we were doing the guided meditation at the beginning of this session. Basically, you direct your mind towards the object or towards awareness, whatever you're orienting to, and you slowly get more and more grounded in that. And then that opens up this inner workspace, and you can just start to notice that physical and mental experiences start to happen. And one of the things that can start to happen is really just this pleasant, nourishing, healing energy in the body. It can be very subtle. It's not necessarily like some kind of orgasmic, ecstatic feeling. It can be, but it's not necessarily that. It can be just a very, almost like a very subtle vibration of just, it just feels like your body is just releasing and relaxing and unwinding a bit. And as I said, that this particular one has been helpful for me. And I think in the modern world that we live in, this is going to vary from person to person, of course. But I think it's especially helpful because we live in a world that is very depleting. If you go back even probably 50 years, certainly 100 or 200 years ago, if you think about what life was like historically in Tibet, people were very, very connected to things that kind of fill us up at both a physical, a mental, emotional, and perhaps even spiritual level. So part of it is a connectedness to nature. We are, you know, some of us might be, but I think a lot of us, are, you know, don't spend that much time in nature. And if we do, we don't have a lot of time of just being in nature, where we're not doing something. I mean, it's different to be doing stuff in nature than just being there, where there's really no thing you're trying to accomplish or check off the to-do list. So nature is a quality. As I've mentioned this many times in many sessions, but I think the aspect of being and having rituals of being is something we've largely erased in our modern culture. So historically, in probably almost every world culture, there were times where you just had space in your day to exist. Sometimes it was social, sometimes it would be solitary. But there was just this period to unwind. The relational quality is, I think, another one. You know, here in the U.S., you know, you see people eating their lunch literally while they're walking down the street, you know, or they have 5 or 10 minutes to eat while they're looking at their computer. You know, some places in Europe, I think there's still a long lunch, you know, where you might take an hour or two. I have a dear friend in France, and I know, despite that he's a really busy guy and they do so much work, but yet they still take time with him and his colleagues to have this long lunch and to connect with each other. So it's not that it's been erased everywhere, but I think a lot of places we've really lost touch with a lot of these things. I mentioned that simply because one of the results of that is that we're just depleted on many levels, including our physical level. And this practice where we tune into this nourishing energy that can arise through shamatha practice, I think is even more important. It's always been part of this tradition. I mean, it's one of these five jhana factors, but yet I think it's even more important now simply because we've lost a lot of the things that do this for us. So for me personally, I have been doing nature of mind practice for a long time, as many of you have. And the orientation towards inner experience is usually like you're just orienting to awareness itself. And everything else is just the clouds, right? It is what it is. You have no preference one way or the other. And that really is the practice. And that's been what I've focused on. I have found that having a little bit of periods where actually I'm immersing myself and orienting to that healing energy can be really helpful, knowing that that's not the point or the goal of nature of mind practice, but it almost just it's like it's filling up the tank a little bit. It's revitalizing the whole mental, physical, emotional system. And then you can go back to that practice and there's just a little more energy there to sustain it. So again, I've just found that really helpful. And at a practical level, the instructions are simply to notice that when it happens. It can be as simple as you're breathing and you just notice some places in your body. Again, it might feel like a little vibration. It might feel sometimes even like a little very subtle energy movement. It might feel almost like a pleasant, like flow kind of moving through your body. It can be very subtle. It doesn't have to be anything dramatic. And you just notice that. You're not like trying effortfully to do anything with it. But by attuning to it, it's almost like it becomes an amplifier to the experience. And eventually something happens with the body. It's kind of funny, even as I'm saying this, because I've been working with this practice, it's just the moment you even think about it, it like reactivates that in the whole mental physical system. So eventually it's almost like your body remembers this experience. And the moment you just bring it to mind, it just activates this almost physical experience that's just like filling up your tank. It's almost like a video game where you get like the magical thing and your life meter like goes back up. I mean, it almost feels like that. It's like you're just filling things up. And again, this isn't nature of mind. It's not going to get at the very root of samsara. But what it really does do is it helps create that inner space. And it really, really helps with that pliability and workability. So when the physical experience and also the mental experience, which is just this sense of ease and contentment, it's more mental and emotional than physical. And these two things can happen together or separately. As they come along, the pliability and workability goes way up. So even if you just spend a few minutes of your practice with this, what it does is that when you go back to to doing nature of mind practice, it's just like your mind, you have kind of the energy for it, and your mind is more your friend rather than working against you in that practice. And eventually what you can do is they start to flow together. So at the beginning, it might feel like you're alternating, like you do a little shamatha, and then you go back to nature of mind. Eventually, the shamatha practice is nature of mind practice. You can do everything you're doing, focusing on your breath, kind of immersing in these healing energies in the body, whatever it is. And that's just your nature of mind practice. Like you would work exploring thought activity or exploring sensory experience. They start to flow together. So again, for me, after many years of focusing much more on the nature of mind side and just letting everything be what it is, I actually found these instructions that Mingyi Rinpoche gives from the Abhidharma tradition, it felt like almost like it was a supercharger for nature of mind practice. I've just found it so, so helpful. So in any case, I've now gone through four of these five factors, and I'll just say one more and then we can end with a few minutes of discussion. So we have the directing the mind, sustaining the mind as kind of like the heart of sort of the mechanics of shamatha practice. And then we have these two experiences of joy or bliss, which is a little bit more physical, and then the ease and contentment, which is more mental and emotional, as the third and fourth factors. And as you put all of this together, especially the first two of these, the directing and sustaining part begin to strengthen, and the mind, the whole inner space just feels more grounded and stable. There's this feeling almost like there's this gathering of attention that just stays with whatever the experience might be. So that's the fifth quality. It's almost like this, all of the mental energies are just kind of collected and oriented towards whatever one is working with. So if you're doing open awareness practice, it can be especially magical. It's just like your mind begins to just kind of lock in to the experience, which is so different than much of our life as meditators, where it's just this going to something, getting pulled away, going back to it, getting pulled away, and there's this up and down. Here it's like the mind just boom. It's just almost like it clicks into place and it's just there. So at a certain point it becomes effortless, like it's that collectedness of the mind has so stabilized that it's just, you no longer have to apply any effort. The mind is just kind of clicks in, and then you're just resting in that. One of the examples that can be used for Vipassana practice, but I think applies here as well. It's like you're looking for the light switch and you're kind of clicking it on and it goes off, click it on. And at a certain point, you just turn it on and it's just there. It's just on. And you don't need to worry about it anymore. The light is just on. And at this point, it's the inner experience. It's like meditation is just happening to you. You don't need to apply any effort or do anything. You're just allowing it to keep happening and to keep going, which needless to say is a very magical experience when things just sort of kind of click into place. So a lot of what happens when we meditate and focusing on these shamatha practices is bringing these factors into balance. At the beginning, it's going to feel a lot more like the experience is much more about the first two, because it's working with the monkey mind and distraction and the feeling of being pulled away. And slowly as those strengthen, the other three, the bliss and joy, the contentment, this orienting and collecting of the mind, the one-pointedness, you could say, all of these start to kind of naturally emerge. And then a lot of the practice is exploring them, actually, just nurturing the qualities, exploring them. And as nature of mind practice, it's just magical, because you can orient towards these and explore them. And then just like we do all the time, who's experiencing this? Where's the awareness in this? What is awareness here? So you can bring in a nature of mind element into each of these, into the experiences as the mind begins to stabilize. So that's just a bit of an overview of some of the mechanics of shamatha practice. We're going to get much, much deeper into this, because Mingyur Rinpoche's book goes through very systematically through a series of meditations focused on the breath, which are incredibly helpful, very simple, but very profound and helpful. So we'll have a lot more time to explore this in more depth. But I wanted just to share this here as a starting point, because it's been so, so helpful in my own practice. So why don't we just take the last 10 minutes or so for any questions. As always, you can type anything in the chat. If you would prefer to ask a question or make a comment, you can type it in the chat. And I say this many, many times, but I'll say it again here. I know many of you are not native English speakers, and I would really encourage you, even if your English is not perfect, don't feel shy. I think one of the most wonderful things about the Terroir community is just we have so many people from so many cultures and places. And I personally just love hearing all the accents. And so don't feel like you need to, you know, have any polished English. We would love to hear from you. Even if you're from another country, or you're a total introvert like me who doesn't like to speak up in public, we'd love to hear from you. So, Joseph, looks like you've got your hand up. What's on your mind?
Hi, everyone. Can you hear me okay?
Yep.
Awesome. So I just want to say I'm really, really happy that we're going into this material, because right before I started meditating under Mingyur Rinpoche's instructions, I was working with exactly what you're talking about, these jhana absorptions. And so it felt, I mentioned this to Edwin as well, but I'll say it again here. So like, it felt like when I moved from that practice to Mingyur Rinpoche's, you know, open awareness, it felt like so many of the like the connections I was making in my mind based on those practices, it felt like I put them down a little bit. And then I started working with these, you know, like love and compassion that is here, awareness that is here, as opposed to something that had to be cultivated. And so I'm really, really happy once again to be exploring this material, because now it feels like now I can pick that up back up again and connect with the experience that I've had here with Turgar, these practices. But am I understanding you to say that we are going to be working with those practices, but in a nature of mind kind of way?
Yes, so this is actually fascinating. I wish I had like 5 hours. This would elicit a complete and total geek fest on my part. If it's probably good that we only have an hour today, because if I really got going on this, I wouldn't stop. But what one of the most fascinating things about this territory of practice is the question of what degree of inner stability is needed and helpful from a nature of mind point of view, and how does nature of mind, an insight into nature of mind, affect this progression of inner stability that comes, like, for example, in the classical jhanas. So, for example, Mingyur Rinpoche often says in the very classical Mahamudra metaphor of like the waterfall, the river, and the lake. And this is a kind of a metaphor for the stability of the mind. At the beginning, it's like a raging waterfall, then it turns into like a slow moving river, and eventually it's like a still lake or ocean, just sort of the completely still. And Rinpoche often says that from a nature mind point of view, actually you don't really need to go beyond the second of the two. Like, you don't really need this the lake, the perfect stillness of the mind. And I've had discussions with him about this, and I've asked him things like, okay, I realize you don't need to do, like, you don't have to go beyond that, but is it good to do it if you like if like is it helpful to do it if you can and want to and have the space to do it? So there's been a lot of interesting discussions. I don't want to leave it too much on a cliffhanger, but we can talk about that later. But there's very interesting things, like, for example, nature of mind naturally disrupts the jhana process at a certain point. In particular, and again, there's a lot of debates about this, but one of the debates is, as you get into levels of absorption, are you completely shielded from the senses? Meaning, like, you focus on your breath and everything else drops away and it's just the object and nothing else? Or is there still kind of a light awareness? Like, you're not distracted by it, but you still can sense that there are sounds happening or other things happening. And that's a debate. Like, some people will say it's not true jhana unless you have that pure, like, you're just with the object and nothing else. Well, from the nature of mind point of view, there's very much a thrust saying that not only is that not important, that would actually be an impediment to nature of mind practice to go in that direction. So what you want is just enough stability so that the distractedness is no longer happening, but you don't want anything more than that. Because once you start going beyond that, essentially what you're doing is you're kind of pushing away, you're pushing further into duality rather than dissolving the dualistic structure of the mind. So it's fascinating. We can and will go much deeper into this, but it's one of the most interesting subtle points of practice of, like, just where do you get to the edges of it being helpful, and where does it actually start reinforcing the very thing that you're trying to dissolve in nature of mind practice? And it's just an interesting dynamic because, yeah, you the very thing that's helpful at a certain point can start being a distraction and even an impediment if you kind of get too fixated on it. So, yeah, there's a lot to say here, and it's fascinating territory, and there's a lot of kind of subtlety in practice. And I think there's a lot of just very practical things, like, what do you actually do at the earlier stages to kind of nurture that inner stability? And then what are the signposts at which point you've probably gone far enough and you need to kind of go back into more nature of mind focus. So again, lots of things to talk about here, and we will, but it's a I think a very helpful one for those of us who are, if we're really doing these practices.
Looking forward to it. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Joseph. So let's see, we got a few questions in the chat. Let me just see if I can do a couple quick ones. Laura asked, is there any discussion of light as part of the jhanas, especially as part of bliss, joy, and ease and contentment? So in the Tibetan tradition, well, there's a lot to say about this too. There are certain kind of almost canonical, classical experiences that happen as part of the stabilizing of the mind. These are generally considered nyam, which means like they're passing meditation experiences. But there definitely can be like experiences of light. There can be a lot of experiences of energy movement in the body. There can be a lot of perceptual, even like full-on hallucinations that can happen. And generally the instruction is just to kind of let those go, and it's to view them as a process of the body going through this inner transformation, or as Mingyur Rinpoche refers to it, as an inner purification. It's like the whole subtle body is reworking itself. And perceptual experiences, like you can have all sorts of strange experiences of light, can happen, and you just kind of let them come and go naturally. The important thing is to realize that some people have a lot of emotional experiences. Some people will have a lot of these more like energetic experiences. Some people will have a lot of perceptual experiences. And some people will have almost none of these experiences. And it really does not matter. It really is just a matter. It's like, if you take 100 people and you put them all on a workout regimen to get more physically healthy, they're going to have all sorts of experiences. Some people will get really sore. Some people will, struggle with it or feel very inspired. You'll have all this array of experience, but everybody will be getting healthier, right? It's kind of like that. It's just people are different. I think the challenge is sometimes we tend to think, oh, why am I not having those bliss experiences, or why am I not having those, seeing lights or things like that? It's really not the key point of these practices, but it definitely does. It's part of the discussion for sure. Why don't I just do one more question? Actually, there's a few other great questions, but really good ones. So some of you may have just been at Rinpoche's retreat this last weekend. He taught a Path of Liberation Level 3 and 4 retreat. If you have not been to that yet, I would highly recommend you work on those, because he gives a series of pointing out instructions that are profoundly helpful. And the question here that Christy asked is how to integrate or not the Abhidharma practices with Nectar of the Path. So I'm actually going to talk quite a bit about this in the future sessions, but the way I would look at it is that the nature of mind practices in Rinpoche's lineage are always kind of the heart. They're like the beating heart of the practice. And in many respects, they're always the main focus of practice. So that's kind of like the main, Rinpoche likes to use, say they're like the main dish, is the term he uses for it. However, in addition to that, practices like the Abhidharma ones, I mean, hopefully it's somewhat clear from what I just said today. Shamatha practice and what I just laid out today, these five jhana factors and how you work with them in practice, these are not the main dish, right? They're not the most important thing from the point of view of the way Rinpoche teaches meditation and teaches the path, but they can be really, really helpful as a support and supplement to practice. And that's exactly how I would view them. Like the nature of mind practices he teaches are kind of the main thing, but you can bring in some of these other teachings and practices as a way to support and deepen and just bring a little fresh energy into your own practice. So still for me, like just to use my personal experience, I'm obviously interested in these teachings. I have been in for a long time, but it's been a focal point of my own personal practice over the past year. But still, nature of mind is the main thing for me. That is, was, and always will be kind of the main thing I'm doing in my daily practice and when I do retreat. But I've been working with these Abhidharma teachings, and specifically the Shamatha practices we've been talking about today, just as a way to kind of bring some fresh energy into my practice. So it really just depends on how much time and energy you have to explore them, but I would just view it as just kind of following your heart and your intuition. If it feels like you have the time and energy and it's interesting to you, then you can focus a little bit on these teachings to supplement your practice. On the other hand, if you're busy or you just feel much more drawn to focus on nature of mind and the practices in the path of liberation levels, then that's totally fine too. You don't necessarily have to do these other things. It's really more if you find it supportive to do so. So I think I will leave it there for the time being. But I'm excited to switch gears and explore these teachings with you. I think it's going to be a really fun, hopefully illuminating and inspiring year to be working with this text. And Mingyur Rinpoche, just so you know, if you haven't seen it yet, the full translation of this Abhidharma text that I've been referring to, which is called Stainless Prajna, will be available in the courses. So you'll all have access to that. So thank you for tuning in today. Why don't we just take a moment here to do a short dedication? You can just say in your own mind any normal prayers you do for your own dedication. Let's just dedicate whatever good has come of our hour together to the awakening of all beings. All right. Well, thank you again. If you want to come on and unmute yourself, as we always do, and say hello and goodbye to everyone. Thank you again for tuning in.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Very helpful.
Thanks, everyone.
Love you.